My daughter, we were sitting out back. We had a fire. I had a fire going, and we were roasting hot dogs in the fire. And my daughter gets up and she says, "I shall return, Father, with a heart of a targ and fresh gock."
Awesome.
This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 31 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. In this episode, we'll be discussing speech acts and performative speech inside the Star Trek universe. Mike, welcome to the show. How are you tonight?
I'm doing very well, Zachary. It's good to be here. We took a week off to prepare for the Parsec Awards, and it's great to be back on mic doing another episode, number 31 of Metatrex.
Yeah, I hate to have to postpone our show for a week, but our show, Metatrex, was nominated for a Parsec Award, and it took some time to prepare an entry for that, and that's the reason we had to skip a week. But here we are tonight for episode 31.
It's exciting. I'm looking forward to the conversation talking about speech acts, and we were having some fun in the turbo lift talking about all of the ways speech acts can be conveyed and their meaning, and I'm just looking forward to the conversation.
Well, as I was searching for a topic for us to talk about on this episode of Metatrex, I was actually I'm kind of in the middle of a Next Generation rewatch. I hesitate even to call it a rewatch because I watch the Next Generation off and on quite often. But I was watching the episode Data's Day where there's a wedding between Chief O'Brien and Keiko at the end of Data's Day, and the idea of a wedding inside Star Trek got me thinking about linguistics and this concept of a speech act, that there are certain kinds of verbal, could be written utterances, but mainly verbal utterances that accomplish something, that change the state of affairs. Like when two people get married, you know, they say, "I do," or whatever their affirmation or whatever their vows are, that causes something to happen, right? The state of affairs changed. They're married now, and that's different than the state before they uttered the, you know, the crucial phrases, whatever they are, and whatever kind of ceremony you're in. And it just got me thinking, you know, there's a lot of these inside the Star Trek universe, different kinds of verbal utterances that are, they're not just causes. They don't just cause something else to happen. You know, it's not like shouting at someone across the street and then they turn their head. It's in the speech act itself that the state of affairs gets changed. And there's quite a few of these inside the Star Trek universe. So I thought it would be fun just to take kind of a linguistic, detour from our usual philosophical topics and see if we can flesh out some different kinds of speech acts or performative speech inside the Star Trek universe.
It occurs to me, Zachary, that Starfleet models itself by and large to our modern military, and not just our modern military, but throughout history, the military has been really governed by pomp and order, and speech acts are actually a very prevalent thing in the military, communication. And so it fascinates me, this idea of how the state of affairs change as a result of a speech act. Now, you mentioned a wedding, but we've got really a lot of examples throughout Star Trek that where a speech act saying something changes the state of affairs. And I think it's fascinating because, as we'll talk about later, you know, we have to come to a place to where we ask ourselves, does this really mean anything, or can the same changing of these affairs occur without the speech act, without the formality, without the pomp? So I think this is going to be a fascinating discussion, really.
I think it's easy to take for granted that things like speech acts and performative speech exist. You know, we tend not to dwell on these things. We live our lives and we do use these types of utterances for various purposes that we'll talk about here in a minute when we start to dive in. But when you think about it, I think it's a really strange notion, the idea that merely in saying something, you can make some grandiose change in the state of affairs, something on the kin of you weren't married and now you are, or if you're like, here we are in 2016, it's a presidential election year here in the United States. So on the 20th of January next year, whoever ends up winning the election is going to stand in front of a judge and in front of a crowd of people and is going to take an oath of office, and that person will become the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's a fascinating change. I mean, merely in saying a certain a phrase, an utterance in the right context, you can go from not being president of the United States to being president of the United States. And that's a really strange thing, that merely the act of saying a certain combination of words in the right context can have such a grandiose change in the state of affairs in the universe. And so it's an interesting philosophical question. What kind of change is that? You know, is this some sort of deep metaphysical change in the universe? Is this merely some sort of a social construction? What's going on there when that kind of not just these small optional speech utterances? I think you're right. In Star Trek, in the Federation, in Starfleet, which is similar to our military in a lot of ways, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance, rituals, things that are spoken in certain contexts, orders that are given and whatnot. Mm-hmm. If you strip out all the non-essential ones, I'm thinking about these really big, significant ones, something on the scale of taking an oath of office and you become president of an organization. That is a grandiose change. It's not something I think you can kind of ignore or do without. It's hard to imagine a society without something like those in some way. But when you really dwell on it and you think, what kind of change has taken place there in the universe? You know, are these real changes? Are they just social constructions? And when you really dwell on it, it starts to kind of fall apart. Like, what is actually going on there? Because certainly there is a change that's taken place, but it's not easy to spell out what exactly that change means or what it consists of, or give a decent philosophical analysis of how exactly that works.
Right, absolutely. I don't want to stray away from the idea of speech acts or performative speech, and I don't want to conflate those ideas either, but I think it's fascinating. You know, 25 years of ministry, I've performed literally hundreds of weddings over the years. And as I have performed those weddings, for all but just a couple of them, there was a wedding rehearsal. And all of us, all of our listeners are familiar with the rehearsal. And, you know, perhaps many of our listeners have participated in them. You know, it's funny because I believe that there is an incredible power that is in our words. The power, I really believe the power of life and death are in the tongue. And so I take words pretty seriously. I think for the most part in 2016, most people seem to just take words for granted. We spew things out without giving, you know, much thought to them. We tweet, or, you know, we post our status, and we give very little thought to what we put out there. So, you know, it seems that we, again, for the most part, and I'm painting with a broad brush, we give very little value, I think, sometimes to words, but I think words are a very powerful thing. So much so that when I would do wedding rehearsals, I would refrain in those rehearsals when it come time to say, by the power vested in me, I now pronounce you husband and wife. I wouldn't say that in a wedding rehearsal.
You're worried about accidentally marrying someone before the real ceremony?
Didn't want to give them the idea. But, you know, I also recall being told that legally speaking, they weren't married until I signed the marriage certificate. So you have that, you know, the power of the pen there, which can be a form of speech act. But those words, by the power vested in me, I now pronounce you husband and wife. Those are powerful words that change to people's status in life. And so I would refrain from speaking them in a rehearsal.
I think you hit the nail on the head, though, Mike. It's the question is exactly, what are words? Are they merely words that don't have this deep, significant impact? Or are they powerful in the sense of having the ability to bring about some drastic change, whether in people's lives or in the universe or for society and whatnot? And I don't think that's obvious at all. I think if you're skeptical of this idea of speech acts, that you can accomplish something in reality just with words, then you're going to be more inclined to think, oh, yeah, words, you know, so what if you accidentally say someone is married before they're really married, right? So what if you accidentally give someone a promotion, right? You know, so what if you accidentally promote, you know, Harry Kim to lieutenant one day? You know, it's never going to happen. See, that'll give you reason to be skeptical of words. That never happens.
Right? That never happens. Poor Harry Kim.
But you also mentioned the idea of writing that, you know, legally, you know, in our society, at least, you know, people aren't married until you actually sign the marriage certificate. I think that's just an extension of the same kind of speech utterance, right? It's not a verbal speech utterance. It's more like a written speech utterance. In signing the paper, mm-hmm. The marriage happens and the state of affairs in the world has changed in some way. I don't think it really matters deeply whether it's verbal or not. It's still a some sense of a performative act. It's not a verbal speech act, but it's a written speech act. I think those are just different varieties of the same family of types of utterances.
Yeah, I of course in the context of the marriage, I always looked at it that the speech act, that pronouncement of marriage, was something of spiritual connotation. That was the pronouncement as far as, you know, God and the people were concerned. But legally speaking, until I signed that marriage certificate, at least in terms of the state or you know, the country, whatever. I mean, if you're walking in and you need to change your driver's license and you need to get in the case of you know, say a woman who has taken her husband's last name and now she needs to get a Social Security card, she has to have that legal document. Doesn't matter if she, you know, stood before a preacher and a congregation of people, and it doesn't matter to the state what God has to say about it. It legally speaking, it's that signature on the paper. That's the official speech act as far as the state's concerned.
Well, let's dwell on this for a minute as it relates to the wedding that we mentioned inside Star Trek with Chief O'Brien and Keiko. I think that's just a great example. It's the one that came immediately to mind. There are other weddings in Star Trek, of course, like the wedding of Worf and Jadzia mm-hmm. Dax in Deep Space Nine. We could use that just as well. But the one that came to my mind was Chief O'Brien and Keiko. So what's interesting to me in what you just described is that, you know, I think, yeah, you're right. If you have a religious view in one way or another, words are going to have this spiritual component. A wedding might have a spiritual component.
Sure.
In this metaphysical sense, right? Something spiritually has changed in the course of the ceremony. But Star Trek, even though it does have its religious element, you know, the Klingons have some spirituality and the Bajorans have their spirituality. When I look at Chief O'Brien and Keiko, I don't see a deep spiritual conviction in either one of them. I would say they're largely agnostic, maybe even atheistic. I don't, you know, we don't have enough information, I think, to go on, but I wouldn't put them in the strongly religious category in any sense. So what happened at their wedding? You know, do they think that there's a deep sort of spiritual metaphysical change that's taken place, or are they married kind of purely because Captain Picard says so? And, you know, what kind of change transpired in their eyes? I mean, in the 24th century, you know, relatively agnostic or atheistic, humanistic context that we see most of the Federation taking place in.
Well, that's a fascinating question, in that you're in essence, you're removing God from that equation. However, in terms of the legal ramifications, I don't know, because I don't know in the 24th century what kind of legal documentation is required. However, I would imagine, at least in my headcanon, that the ship's computer is going to record that ceremony.
Yeah, they actually had to step behind Guinan's bar and put their thumb against a pad. You know, that's the 24th century equivalent of signing the marriage certificate. But in this case, it happened behind Guinan's bar.
Yeah, and somewhere Quark's making a profit on that, I'm sure.
Well, at least in Deep Space Nine when Worf gets married. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah. I would imagine that the ship's computer is recording that. And so I'm guessing that that is your, at least in terms of the Federation, that is your legality right there, the official recording of that pronouncement. I don't know that there's, you know, they are they going to pull a pad out? And like you said, you know, maybe it's a thumbprint on the pad by the both of them. Captain Picard saying that, you know, he did officiate it. And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
His brain is gone.
I mean, you can imagine the various challenges to it. You know, I definitely don't want to turn this into a discussion about the religious element, mainly because we've already talked about that in another episode of MetaTrex. But if you take that out of the equation and you start to become skeptical that that performative speech acts like marriage vows make any sort of metaphysical impact on the universe, that they're merely social constructions, you can imagine sort of, I can imagine Data having this conversation, actually. This is Data's day, right? I can imagine Data sort of questioning, wait a minute, what just happened here? You guys said your vows and now you're married, but isn't all of this just some sort of social construct? Doesn't that mean you're not really married in some sort of deep sense? Yeah, we said you're married. Captain Picard said you're married. We all sort of, you know, clap our hands and shake and we dance after Data dances with the doctor after. but what has really taken place? Isn't this just some sort of social construction that hasn't actually made a metaphysical dent in the universe in some way? So, you know, would Data be justified in saying, look, nothing actually changed here. You just said some words. You know, your molecules are still exactly where they were. The ship was going on exactly as it was. So what exactly changed? Yeah, it's just some sort of a useful fiction that we tell ourselves. So these concepts that seem to be invoked by performative speech acts, like saying a marriage vow or giving someone a promotion or taking an oath. We're going to list a few of these here in a few minutes. But, you know, are all of these basically just useful fictions that we tell ourselves to get through society but don't have any real metaphysical impact on reality?
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. And I think if you do remove, at least in the context of weddings, if you remove the religious element, then yes, you know, that the as you call it, the, you know, the metaphysical element gets removed. And
the metaphysical dent.
The metaphysical dent is removed.
Lack of a better word.
And so what you have left, you know, you have to ask the question, is the speech act necessary? It doesn't really change anything. You're absolutely right. The molecules are the same. Everything's the same. They have the same exact number of brain cells and the same exact number of nothing has changed except the perception of the people. That's it.
Yeah, certainly there's a change in the causal chain that happens, right? When you, again, just kind of using Miles and Keiko's wedding as a prototypical example here, you know, after the wedding, there's going to be some stuff that happens. People are going to congratulate them. They're going to go back to their own quarters. They're eventually going to have a baby. And it starts this whole causal chain, mm-hmm. right, that wouldn't have transpired otherwise. So in that sense, you know, going through the ceremony has caused a new state of affairs to emerge out of that. But I don't think that's what speech acts really are intended to be. It's not just that uttering some words causes future events to happen. The idea behind a performative speech act is that in saying the speech, you know, or the utterance, whatever it is, depends on which kind we're talking about, whatever the utterance is, that doing that in itself has caused a change to transpire. So it's not just that it, you know, people are going to treat them differently. It's that they're married now, and that means something, you know, that it's something that's true about the universe that wasn't true, you know, just a few seconds before. Has nothing to do with the sort of subsequent causal chain that emerges out of that event.
Sure. This past weekend, Zachary, I had the wonderful pleasure of celebrating my 22nd wedding anniversary. And
well, congratulations.
Thank you. And it's fascinating because, you know, when I was a young man, I dated, I had girlfriends, and I had a couple of girlfriends that I had for, you know, for quite a while. And you know, I think back on those relationships, and as all relationships, all dating relationships do at some point or another, and unless the end result is a long-term commitment, you know, be it just a commitment, or whether you take that step and actually get married, most of those relationships are going to hit a bump somewhere, and those relationships are going to end. And so I think back over 22 years of marriage, and my wife and I have a wonderful marriage, but it hasn't been without bumps and bruises along the way. You know, we've had our fair share of ups and downs, like any couple, just like the O'Briens. They've had their ups and downs.
Well, Mike, actually, Guinan's got the perfect advice for you. Just because a woman walks out on you doesn't mean she doesn't wish you to follow.
Indeed.
Lessons learned from Star Trek.
So, you know, I think about the bumps that, you know, we've encountered along the way. But, you know, 22 years ago, I stood before a congregation of people and I said, I, Mike, take Dorinda to be my lawful wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish until death do us part. And when I said those words, I meant them. And it was a covenant, a commitment that I was making to her. So as we have hit those obstacles along the way, it's not as easy for me to get out. I made a commitment. I spoke words that had meaning. And so when you hit those bumps, you dig in, because I did promise to love and cherish her regardless of the circumstances. And I think, again, it comes down to, you know, do we take our words, do we take these speech acts seriously or not?
I think you're hitting on something really interesting. You what you're describing to me is kind of the sincerity behind it. You know, you didn't just say the words, you meant the words.
Absolutely.
And for all of these kinds of speech acts, things like taking an oath, things like giving wedding vows, you know, becoming president, whatever it is, you know, there's a sincerity component of that, that if the sincerity is not there, if it's deceptive in some way, it kind of invalidates the speech act, right? You can give a faithless oath or a faithless vow in some way.
Sure.
And that raises the question, how do we ever know that we can take people's utterances seriously? Do you need a Vulcan there to do a mind meld to make sure that you're being sincere? You know, but again, I put myself in Data's shoes. How does Data know that this isn't just a sort of a theater act, you know, that we're acting out a wedding on the holodeck, or that this is the rehearsal, that this is the real deal, and that there's a sincerity component to it? I think what we're starting to flesh out a little bit is that it's not just enough to say the words. The words have to have the right context in the right time period, with the right surroundings, and with the right mental component, with the right intention.
Sure.
And if any of those things is missing, the speech act or the performative utterance hasn't occurred. So there are some necessary conditions that have to be fulfilled for there to be a genuine speech act, it sounds like.
I think you're hitting the nail on the head. And statistics show 50% of the time, those components aren't present, because, you know, 50% of the time that marriage vow is going to be broken in one way or another, and that marriage is going to be dissolved. And so, you know, I throw that out there to say, again, I think it really boils down to what the commitment is behind the words, not necessarily the words themselves, but the commitment.
Well, Mike, let's move on to talk about some other types of speech acts in Star Trek. So, yeah, we've kind of fleshed out weddings pretty well, and that's the one that came immediately to my mind, and was sort of the genesis of the idea for talking about performative speech acts on Metatrex today.
And it's funny, Zachary, though you thought of Miles and Keiko first. That was the one that came to your mind, and funny enough, the first wedding that came to my mind actually never happened. And that was the wedding of Tomlinson and Martine in the original series, Balance of Terror. It never was completed because of the Romulan incident. And so that was actually the first one that came to my mind. But, you know, at the end of that,
it's a failed speech act. Is that what you're saying?
A failed speech act. But the thing that I really got
Speechus interruptus.
What's that?
Speechus Romulus interruptus.
Speechus Romulus interruptus, indeed. But, you know, the thing that got me at the end of the episode, you know, Martine is in the chapel and Kirk comes in, you know, and to console her. And so I found myself, as I watched that recently, asking myself the question, you know, is she any less married because the speech act didn't happen? I mean, she, to me, she was a wife in mourning, even though that wedding didn't occur. So again, I think it raises some questions, certainly, about the speech act itself. There are other great weddings, Sisko and Cassidy. You mentioned Worf and Jadzia. We've got in Nemesis, we have the marriage of Riker and Troi. There are some really good weddings that we could, you know, we could get in. Tom and B'Elanna, lots of weddings there that we could get into and talk about. But I think about how different each of them were, and each of them had their own elements. Worf and Jadzia certainly was probably as different as any of them. Miles and Keiko, because of the Japanese element, the traditional Japanese element. But the thing that I find fascinating are these speech acts in the context of culture too. And I don't want to not move on, but I think that bears fleshing out a little bit as well.
Well, I think you're right. I guess what I want to ask, are there any of those, I mean, you'll mention several weddings inside Star Trek. Are there any that stand out from a speech act perspective where there's something so unique about the culture, where there's such a different kind of requirement or different kind of necessary condition on the speech act that really changes the character of it, where it's not just a matter of saying the words, there needs to be a bunch of other stuff that happens in order for there to be a genuine state and a change in the state of affairs, in other words, for a wedding to have actually taken place.
Well, I mean, if you're just talking sheer cool, I mean, I don't think there's any argument that Worf and Jadzia's wedding was just absolutely cool. There was a dramatic element to it. It wasn't just a ceremony.
Performative
of
bloodletting. Yeah. That's how Klingon weddings go. Performative bloodletting. But Mike, you raise a really interesting point that, you know, if speech acts themselves are dependent on a particular culture, if a traditional Japanese wedding, like we see between somewhat traditional Japanese wedding between Keiko and Miles, is if that has different criteria than a Klingon wedding with its ritual bloodletting, you know, then, you know, can you give any kind of, does it even make sense to say that speech acts cause something to happen in the universe? I mean, the whole idea behind a speech act is that in the speech itself, you know, the state of affairs has changed. But if you start to say, no, it's really relevant to culture, and it's really, you know, different cultures have all these other criteria, you know, you have to be dressed a certain way, or you have to, you know, pierce someone a certain way, whatever it is, then doesn't that undermine the very idea that the speech act itself is doing some sort of work to bring about a change in the state of affairs in the world in some way?
Well, if you're on Beta Zed, probably it would be best not to be clothed when you get married. Somehow that seems to affect the quality of the speech act.
Yeah, and that's more like, you know, speech telepathy act, right? They're very quiet weddings on Beta Zed.
Very quiet and open. Very open. But, you know, the thing back to Worf and Jadzia, the thing that I found fascinating about that, and you talk about speech acts, is that it wasn't just the formality and the pomp. There was a dramatic element to it. They were telling a story. And it wasn't just the words, but it was also their actions. You had the beating that occurs at the end of the episode. I laugh because I think about Sisko and O'Brien and Bashir. They've got those sticks, and they're just waiting. They just want that chance to go up there and beat Worf half to death. And hold on.
Well, Mike, I'm glad you mentioned the story element, because this is something that comes up again and again for Klingons. I'm thinking of the episode of The Next Generation when Alexander, an older version of Alexander, comes back in time to try to kill the younger version of himself. Mm-hmm. He's changed his name to Kimtar, I think, for the episode. Isn't that right?
I believe that's right.
Okay. you know, Kimtar has to remind Alexander, basically remind himself, that it's the telling of the stories that are important. You know, young Alexander is trying to kind of analyze this story about Kaelas that Kimtar is telling him. And Kimtar has to say, look, these are our stories. This is who we are. And for Klingons, there is something deep and important about the telling of the story. It's not so much, it's not accomplishing anything deep and metaphysical like you sort of think of a wedding is doing, maybe. But it does kind of ground their society in some way, and it's an important ritual to go through. Telling the stories is important in itself, and if you don't do that, you're missing some crucial aspect of being a Klingon. So part of being a good Klingon is having this kind of verbal utterance and going through the ritual.
Yeah, the episode that you're referring to, Firstborn, that was a big part of Alexander's education to get him to understand that it's the telling of these stories, and that these stories are inherently tied to the Klingon identity. And so to be fully Klingon, you have to gain some appreciation for the meaning within the stories, or at least that's my take on it.
But think how radical this is, what you just said is, Mike. In order to be a real Klingon, you have to embrace telling the story. So again, we have an interesting case now of a certain kind of verbal utterance, you know, the ritual of telling a story, being tied to your personal identity in some way, being a real Klingon. And again, if that's just words, then there's no problem, right? If that doesn't actually mean anything substantive. But if there's a deep sort of substantive sense of being a genuine Klingon or having an identity in some way, if that's not just an empty, vacuous concept, then there is some relationship between the utterances and your personal identity. And that's not easy to spell out, I think.
Well, and the fascinating thing, too, let's remember that sentiment. I mean, is it really Klingon? Because that sentiment certainly is something that Worf has held on to and obviously passed down to his son. Because as we've seen Worf interact with other Klingons, and as we've seen Worf take on mentoring roles a couple of times in his story arc, it really is about the stories and the legends so that's something that's very important to Worf. Whether that's true of all Klingons, I don't know, but certainly to Worf, somewhere that story, that speech act, takes on a powerful connotation with him.
So far we've got weddings and we've got Klingons telling stories. There are a couple types of speech mm-hmm. acts. The next one on my list is in Star Trek is promotions and transfers of command.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, in this hypothetical possible universe in which Harry Kim actually gets a promotion, when Captain Janeway says, you know, I now promote you, you know, Ensign Kim to Lieutenant, and you're now Lieutenant Kim, you know, in that kind of utterance, there's a change, you know, Ensign Kim becomes a lieutenant. Is there anything sort of unique and interesting about this idea of a promotion or a transfer of command? Like, you know, like when Jellicoe takes command of the Enterprise, you sort of say, you know, computer, transfer the command codes to blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And now someone else is captain of the Enterprise. And that's a big change. That's a different captain of an entire starship. These are not little insignificant changes, right? So is there anything kind of interesting or different or significant about that kind of a speech utterance compared to weddings or compared to, you know, Klingons telling stories?
Well, again, I find it fascinating because, you mentioned Jellicoe from Chain of Command. The thing that I find fascinating about that was the pomp that was pulled into that. I mean, he's got a pad, he reads on there, you know, the official orders from Starfleet ordering the transfer of command, and, you know, at least Picard does. He reads those transfer orders and, you know, he speaks to the computer, transfers the codes, and
it's done. He's not the captain of the Enterprise.
Yeah, it's
anymore.
Done. And yeah. And with the words, I relieve you, sir, and then Picard says, I stand relieved.
And that always hits me as a really somber moment. I mean, Captain Picard giving up command of the Enterprise.
Yes.
You know, whatever you think of Jellicoe, and I think, you know, he kind of gets a bad rap in some ways. He's in a crisis situation. But that's an interesting moment where in saying those words, there's a finality to it. And I think there are these moments in life where our words have a sense of finality to it. Saying goodbye to someone, or ordering someone to their death inside Star Trek, mm-hmm. right? You know, these things where you know that's going to be the end of the end of the road and for some significant event in some way. I hear just a finality to that, I relieve you, sir. And boom, all of a sudden that the state of affairs has changed. Captain Picard is no longer captain of the Enterprise. And it kind of almost brings a little tear to my eye. Not quite, but it's almost.
But they do the same thing in STO-9 with Captain Pike and Captain Kirk. You know, when he and almost word for word, verbatim, those same words, I relieve you, sir, I stand relieved. And yet you have a moment where you feel really good. Destiny has been fulfilled. Kirk is captain of the Enterprise. And so is that the dramatic element or?
Well, there's an emotional component to it, and I think my concern here is that the emotional component is a bit of a distraction, right? It doesn't matter what your reaction to it, emotional reaction to it is. What matters is whether things have actually changed. In this case, saying those words in the right context has relieved Captain Picard, and he's no longer captain of the Enterprise. And as I'm talking about that, I'm thinking back to an earlier episode of Metatrex that we did called the Starship of Theseus, mm-hmm. in which we talked about the identity of objects over time and how those objects keep their identity as they undergo changes, as their parts get swapped in and out, as time passes and whatnot. And it occurred to me that one of the things we talked about in that episode is this kind of reductionist approach to macroscopic objects in the world. If you take big objects like starships and you say, well, starships, the only thing starships are just collections of parts, right? There's a warp core and there's nacelles and there's a bridge module, and you put all this stuff together in the right way and you get a starship. And then each of those components, you can break it down into its components. There's isolinear chips, and on Voyager, there's neural gel packs, and you can keep breaking this down and farther down. And if you keep going down, you get atoms, then you get subatomic particles, and whatever the sort of fundamental level of physics is, you can just say all this stuff is just reducible to whatever this lowest level of physics is. So there aren't things like starships. There aren't things like starship captains. There aren't things like isolinear chips. There's just whatever the lowest level is, the lowest basic level of subatomic particle, and whatever forces and equations define all of that. That's all reality is. Everything else is just an illusion. So if you take this reductionist approach, you can kind of explain the problem away. You can say, well, look, we don't have to worry about who's captain of the Enterprise because there aren't things like starships. There's just molecules and atoms and mm-hmm. subatomic particles. So no, the Speech Act doesn't actually do anything because starships aren't even real in the first place. They're totally reducible to whatever that lowest level of physics is. So as often happens in metaphysics, this kind of reductionist approach threatens to undermine the very concept that we're talking about here, right? If that reductionist approach holds water and you can try to explain away all these higher level concepts, then it seems like the problem of speech acts just goes away because the terms involved, the references for the language, the things the language points to that is supposed to bring about a change in the state of affairs, just plain don't exist.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, but I'm sure when Captain Picard is walking down the corridor after turning over command of the Enterprise to Jellicoe, I have to wonder, did he stop at some point in time and say, computer, this is Captain Jean-Luc Picard, security clearance Alpha 001, self-destruct mode. Just
well, there, if the Enterprise doesn't exist, then who cares, right? But I guess my point is not to be a negative point. I guess my point is this: it works both ways. If you think there's something wrong with that reductionist approach, if reducing away all of these meaningful higher level concepts to the basic level of physics, if you think that doesn't hold water philosophically in some way, if you lose something important about our conception of reality,
sure.
then you're forced to say, well, these higher level things do exist, right? Starships do exist, and people getting married exist, and personal identity exists, and all whatever the full spectrum of higher level concepts is. And that means if those are part of our reality, because we're not reducing them away, and we really think they exist above and beyond the constituent components that make them up, then it's possible to change them and affect them. And words are one way to do that. So I think a very effective way to argue for this kind of performative speech act is just outright to reject the reductionist approach and try to give some justification for thinking that you can't, take every element of reality and just reduce it to physics. I think it's plausible that you lose some important features of our description of reality and our experience if you reject those concepts. But if those concepts are real and they refer to something actual, starships are an actual part of the universe above and beyond their molecules, then it's possible to change to transfer command of a starship, exactly what we see in Star Trek. It sounds kind of obvious, like of course you can transfer command of a starship, right? But if you're really entertaining the notion that maybe starships don't exist, then that undermines this idea that we can cause things to happen with our words.
Zachary, are you telling me that I need to free my mind? I feel like I've been in the ready room with Captain Morpheus.
Oh, I'm gonna.
That's another franchise, but.
if we're in the ready room, I'm just gonna take a nap on the cot in the corner like I always do.
Yeah, I feel like I've just spent a couple of minutes with Captain Morpheus.
Well, again, I think this is hard. I think there's two ways to approach this kind of discussion. I think if you find yourself not able to entertain the notion that higher level objects and concepts are reducible, this is going to sound like a crazy idea to say things like starships aren't real and human beings aren't real and isolinear trips aren't real. Right. If you're going to christen a starship, Star Trek Generations, when the bottle of
champagne, floating across the,
beautifully smashes into the Enterprise B, right. And all of a sudden, boom, it's named the Enterprise. Yes. It's a christening, right? I think my point, Mike, is just that if you aren't able to entertain this idea that these higher level objects are reducible and that they don't really exist, then you're not going to find any of this very convincing. Mm-hmm. That, this idea that speech acts, there's such an ordinary part of our existence, the idea that we can accomplish things with our words. We can come up with 100 examples. We've got a few from Star Trek here: weddings and promotions and taking an oath and christening a starship. You can come up with a bunch more, but we take so much of that for granted that we tend not to take our skeptical philosophical questioning and really questioning, like, what is going on there? Is this real or is this not real? And one way of sort of putting the philosophical pressure on that idea is to say, well, look, if the terms that these performative utterances are supposed to refer to, if the entities in the world don't really exist for these skeptical reductionist reasons, then the problem just goes away. There is no problem of performative utterances because none of the reference are there. Mm-hmm. If you don't find that very convincing, if you just sort of rely on your ordinary intuition, it just seems so obvious. These things exist, right? Higher level objects and terms and entities and beings exist. So yeah, insofar as we're interacting at this higher level of description with human beings and starships in it, then of course we can make a change in the state of affairs by interacting totally at that level and not worrying about what's going on at this micro level of description, this reductionist level of description. So I think what's hard is to motivate the other side to take, whichever side you fall on, to motivate the other side to take the other idea seriously, because on the one hand, everything, the idea of performative speech acts is so obvious, we take it for granted. How could you question that certain kinds of speech cause things to happen?
Sure.
On the other hand, it's not obvious at all that you can't just reduce everything to this lower level of description. That's what physicists try to do all the time, right? That's like the physicist mode of being is to take, whatever the higher level entities are and analyze them totally in terms of whatever's going on at the micro level. And so it's just not obvious at all which direction is the right way to go. I think there's good arguments to be made for both cases. And the issue of performative speech utterances might just hinge on how that discussion shakes out.
As you were talking there, Zachary, it's a strange thought, but the thought occurred to me, or at least I should say my mind went back to Spock when he said to, I believe it was Valeris, that you just have to have faith that the universe is going to unfold as it should. And let's take that and apply that to this idea that, these speech acts, these performative speeches are reducible and unnecessary. And so I think the picture that's coming to my mind is the description that Quinn gives to the Q continuum, where they have ceased to talk and debate and question and explore, and they, in essence, as a society, have become very stagnant. And so, again, not to take anything away from the idea of how these speech acts may be reducible, but I have to think that their importance transcends whether or not these metaphysical things matter or not. I think it transcends that.
I think you're right. I mean, imagine like you're describing, the Q continuum has become silent because everything's already been said.
Yes.
No ideas are being exchanged. What you're describing to me says that it's the sort of verbal exchange of ideas that can be the lifeblood of a society, right? It could be as cartoonish as what you're seeing in the political debates, right? Republicans and Democrats kind of duking it out. But it's the idea that, look, in order for society to move forward, people have to be putting ideas out there. People have to be challenging those ideas. And that provides this dialectic framework within which society moves forward. And if you don't have that, then society gets stagnant.
Exactly.
In some way.
And the universe doesn't unfold as it should.
So
or does
at
it?
Least for society, these speech acts in some broad sense is an important aspect of society. It grounds society in some way. If you don't have that, you have kind of a dysfunctional society. You could have a totalitarian society where speech isn't allowed. You could have a stagnant society like the Q continuum where people are just bored to tears all the time. You could have what would be a Cardassian society in which there's no free speech and people are put on display and punished, and whatever it is, when there's an absence of healthy speech acts, society seems dysfunctional. So again, that's not kind of a metaphysical reading of speech acts. It's this practical, societal, almost Aristotelian sense of speech acts, that it's in the exchange and debate about ideas and what society should be and challenging those ideas, that in that that exchange, that often verbal exchange, it could be written exchange, but often it's a verbal exchange, society moves forward. In fact, it really calls to mind Hegel to me, the idea that in having this dialectic, this back and forth of oppositions, you can reach a middle ground that really moves society forward towards some ideal, towards some goal. But it's all tied to speech acts, and it's not speech act in some metaphysical sense. We're not talking about spiritually becoming married, in some way that you weren't before. We're not talking about some weird metaphysical baptism of a naming of a starship. This is some practical sense that, look, speech acts are just an important part of society, and if you don't have them in the right kind of way, society can be really dysfunctional.
Yeah, and again, it kind of amazes me how, not just in the Star Trek universe, but in our own, how we have this tendency to take a speech act and add our own flair to it. For instance, you mentioned earlier promotions. I mean, we've seen a few promotions, unfortunately not Harry Kim, but we've seen a few promotions in the Star Trek universe. I mean, after all, Tom Paris got promoted. We got, we got to see Janeway add a pip to his collar, and Deanna Troi comes to mind. She got promoted. I think it was season 7 of The Next Generation.
I'm thinking, bring out the prisoner.
Well, and Zachary, that's exactly where I'm going. So, we get to, TNG Generations, and so we have a promotion on a Hollywood budget now. or a holodeck. If I'm Deanna Troi, I'm not really happy that they didn't throw a big holodeck soiree for my promotion. That's just me. you would figure, of course, Tom was the holodeck program writer on Voyager, so it would have been a little self-serving for him to write his own promotion holodeck program, but so somebody could have been thought. I mean, obviously, Tuvok has some skills, so Tuvok could have gone and written some kind of promotion protocol into the holodeck. They could have had some fun with it. But I think it's interesting that seriously, in Generations, we have this big pageantry, with this ship and the ocean and the costumes and. you know, promotion on a Hollywood budget, but you know, I think it's interesting how we add our own flair, and that's true in life as well. I mean, you know, not to go back to weddings, but not all weddings are the same. Some of them are, you know, I've seen people literally drop six figures on a wedding. And then you have some very simple ones. And for instance, I performed a wedding one time in the living room of a home, and that couple, it was no less married than the couple that I performed their ceremony, and they dropped $100,000 on the ceremony. That's the thing that fascinates me.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of extraneous stuff there. Right? In order to get to the heart of what actually happened there and what's essential, you have to strip away all those optional non-essentials, right? Like, you don't really have to have a big ceremony. You don't really have to have a wedding cake, right? All this stuff is stuff you can strip away and you can still have a wedding. But there is some sort of core essence without which you just don't have a wedding, right? So there is a common element, and it usually has a verbal component to it.
Yeah. Well, back to the promotions, you know, I guess the question here is, what connotes a promotion? What is, you know, what is the stuff that makes that promotion up? It's kind of like the idea that you had with the Starship. If they hadn't had christened the Enterprise B, would it be any less a Starship?
It might be the Excelsior. Scotty thinks that's less of a Starship.
I mean, when Sisko was given, of course, we know,
it's just a bucket of bolts, right?
I mean, we know why in our world, in the real world, why when Sisko was given the new Defiant class ship, there was a special dispensation in the orders for them to change the name. We know why. It was a budgetary thing. But again, you know, what was it? Was it any less the Defiant without that dispensational?
But again, this is just kind of a strange idea to me, and I really want listeners to kind of let this sink in a little bit. This idea that in naming something, you know, whether it's choosing a name for a person, like for a child, I'm even thinking of like the Doctor choosing his own name mm-hmm. on Voyager. Like if he all of a sudden decided to call himself Dr. Schweitzer. Right. And that's his name. That's who he is now. That's how people are going to refer to him. That changes his sense of identity. And that is now, he's now Dr. Schweitzer. And that's not just a superficial change. That's now who he is.
Joe.
Right. Joe. Exactly. But christening a starship is the same kind of thing, right? If you say, I'm going to take the bottle of Chateau Picard, I'm going to smash it against the bow of the new starship. And you say, you know, this is now the Enterprise. Mm-hmm. I mean, just think about what that means. That is now a true statement. This is the Enterprise is now true. And that's a big, significant thing inside Star Trek, right? This is now another Starship Enterprise. But, you know, I guess my point is just that's such a strange idea.
It is.
such a little thing can have such a massive consequence, like, you know, a Starship becoming what it is and having the meaning that it conveys.
When you talk about choosing a name, certainly the Doctor's first that comes to mind. I think about the thought that was given by Data in naming Lao. So we put a lot of thought into, we agonize over naming things, saying the right words. I mean, that's why we have a wedding rehearsal. That's why we read the orders off the pad rather than, you know, try to just... Because the words have to be a certain way in a certain order, or at least that's the way it is in our mind. But at the end of the day, Zachary, you have to kind of push back against this and say, does it really matter? Is that any less the Enterprise B? If we had not gone through this pompous ceremony, these formalities, would the Enterprise D have been any less under the control of Captain Jellicoe rather than Captain Picard? Would Captain Kirk have been any less the captain of the JJ Prize as opposed to Captain Pike?
Mike, do you remember back in 2009 when Barack Obama was sworn in as President of the United States and the Chief Justice flubbed the oath of office?
Yes.
Yeah. And
they had to do it again.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point I was gonna make. That there, you know, in some people's minds, this is ridiculous. He's president. He was elected. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what the actual words are, right? In other people's minds, this is really important. You're not actually president until you say the words in the right order, in the right context. And so, yeah, there was a real genuine question about whether or not he was president until he took the actual oath of office. And they did a second version of it in a quieter, you know, closed doors kind of ceremony the next day, right? But, you know, again, this is not a little distinction, right? This is a question of, is this person actually president or not president? And it, for some people, it really did hinge on the correct order of the words, the speech utterance. And for other people just thought that was ridiculous. Like, yes, he's president. Why are we going through this? This is a dumb, you know, dumb question to even question whether he's legitimately the president because of those, that kind of thing. But I guess my point is that it's not obvious that we do place a lot of meaning on circumstance, ceremony and pomp and circumstance and saying things in the right context, in the right order. And unless that's done, we sort of don't think crucial milestones have been reached, that certain kinds of events have happened. So I don't want to, you know, make it a political discussion, but it was very interesting to see that the sort of two camps that emerged immediately after that flub of the oath of office in 2009, because it really highlights the distinction between these two different views of language. On the one hand, language is deep and metaphysical and causes things to happen. On the other hand, they're just words and it doesn't really matter. What matters is the rest of, in that case, it was what matters was the election. Who cares what the actual words were? And I think that the emphasis you place on language is going to be tied to, you know, your view of reality and what those words are supposed to accomplish in changing that fundamental level of reality.
Yeah. And you mentioned the election. This is an election year. You know, it occurs to me that all across this country, we are engaging in these speech acts that we call primary elections. You know, we go in and we declare who we wish to be the nominee for our respective political parties. And those votes have meaning and they carry weight. And we're going to do this again in November to elect a president here in the United States. So it occurs to me that some speech acts require a certain level of consensus. And again, I don't want to get into a political discussion, because certainly we could talk about majority as opposed to electoral college, and we can go all kinds of places with this. But nevertheless, the system that we have in place is the system we have in place. And so there still has to be a certain level of consensus there in order for that speech act to be carried out to, you know, whoever that person is that is going to, you know, win the election. And it occurs to me the same's true in Star Trek. We've talked about weddings, and there are two people involved in that wedding. It takes consensus, and the captain is certainly part of that in some cases, or Admiral Ross, in the case of Sisko and Cassidy. So there is, you know, the idea that there's consensus there, the two parties and, you know, the clergy or the officiate who's in charge. It occurs to me when you're talking about changing command, there has to be consensus. There has to be the captain who is relinquishing and the captain who is accepting command. It occurs to me that in giving an order such as auto-destruct, at least up until Voyager, required multiple people. Sometimes we see that it took three people. Sometimes we see that it took two people. Now, personally, it seems to me Enterprise D, all 1,018 of those people are affected. So I don't know. Should there have been 1,018 people go up to and there should there have been consensus? But no, we give the responsibility of those lives to the captain and the first officer.
I love that a minute ago, Mike, you used the example of casting your vote, you know, as we do in a democratic or a republic society in which, you know, we cast our vote for certain things, right? There's a reverence associated with that, and I think that's tied up with the notion of a speech act. It's not merely giving an opinion in some sort of passive sense, like, oh, I really wish Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or whoever's going to get elected. I wish one of them would become president, right? It's casting a vote is a type of act. It's a declaration of what you want the world to be. And that's tied up with our sense of freedom and empowerment and these crucial concepts that define us as a democratic society. So even something as simple as casting a vote is a type of act. And I think this is such a fundamental concept in a society like ours, that it's our ability to speak and voice our opinion and say you know, how we want our society to be and speak for ourselves about that. That is it's just such a crucial part of our society, right? That's a type of an action that's empowering. And if you don't have that, either you don't have the speech, or if the speech is hollow and doesn't have the sort of force behind it of saying, I'm declaring this is what the kind of society I want it to be, you can end up with a really, you know, disempowered group of people in non-democratic societies. And so, you know, this concept is a really, we've kind of been making light of it. We've been talking about some examples that I think are a little fluffy, right? Things like weddings and things like taking oaths and, you know, things like getting promotions, you know, whether Harry Kim's going to get a promotion. But at a deep fundamental level, it seems like something like casting your vote in a democratic society. And it makes me wonder what casting your vote for the president of the Federation is like. You know, what kind of oath of office does the president of the Federation take? I don't know if we ever hear that. We never really hear much about an election or how that goes or the mechanics of it. But in our society, at least, things like elections are supposed to be empowering. They're a type of action. If you don't have that in society, if you don't have that empowerment, you end up with a non-democratic society in which people are not very empowered. And that's not the kind of society we want to live in. And so I think for us, at least, this is a really crucial concept that if you lose that idea that a speech can be a type of an action, then it undermines the democratic foundation of our society. And that would be really disastrous. Mm-hmm. So I want to just kind of up the seriousness of it. This is a really serious idea that society is really dependent on it in some way. So these skeptical concerns about it have the potential to undermine our sense of society. If speech acts aren't real, then what the hell are we doing when we are casting a vote in an election mm-hmm. year? You know, what the hell happens when there's a change of command on the Enterprise? You know, when citizens of the Federation vote for the president of the Federation, presumably that happens in some way. And if speech acts aren't real, the significance of those kinds of events is significantly undermined, I think.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into a critique of Star Trek as a whole, but I think you're exactly right that we unfortunately don't get to see kind of that political element. We don't get to see an election of a Federation president. Is it a democratic process, or is it something that is given to, you know, just a select group of delegates, perhaps from each planet, the Federation Council? We don't know. We don't know how that process goes down in the Star Trek universe. And what a shame it is that we didn't really get to see that in 700 plus episodes of Star Trek and, you know, the movies. And we didn't really get to see that element of it. But you're absolutely right. All these kind of fluffy examples aside, there's something very impactful about it. And honestly, probably the best example that kind of demonstrates the gravity of a speech act, as I mentioned just a moment ago, this idea of an auto-destruct command. Because for Captain Picard and Commander Riker, they have 1,000-plus lives on the other end of that joint command when they put their hand on the panel and they, you know, input their personal security codes, and, you know, they do the voice authentication and, you know, self-destruct. Does the first officer concur? Yes. And with that starts a countdown that's essentially going to end over 1,000 lives.
You know, it's fascinating because, you know, we've kind of been using some really lightweight, fluffy examples of speech acts, but that's a really serious one, right? If you have the power to destroy an entire starship and take 1,000 lives, you know, with a command to a computer, right? I mean, it's literally an action. It's the power to destroy only with words, of course, with the computer's help. But, you know, it's all triggered by words.
Right.
These aren't hollow words that fall on deaf ears. This is the power of life and death to create or destroy inside the Star Trek universe solely with words. And that's an amazing, that's literally a speech act. It's an act writ large.
Well, you think about the power that Captain Picard has. He can step up to a replicator and he can say, T. Earl Grey hot. And that really has very little weight. He gets a nice hot cup of Earl Grey.
But it's magic, though. He created the cup of tea using only his words. I mean, you know, this is the kind of stuff you get in science fiction that's just this fun to think about. You know, when you have things like replicators, you can literally bring something into fruition that wasn't there before on a whim, at your own command, right? You can literally make something out of nothing. Maybe not literally out of nothing, because, you know, there's, you know, whatever matter they're using, or matter energy conversion technique to make this cup of Earl Grey. But that aside, you know, the cup of Earl Grey didn't exist before. And then Captain Picard says, "Tea, Earl Grey hot." And then there's a cup of tea there. It's an amazing power to kind of manifest something solely out of your imagination with the computer's help. That's a kind of speech act we don't have in our society. I can't just manifest a cup of tea, although I wish I could half the time. It's just an amazing creative power that you see inside this inside Star Trek, that it's some variety of a speech act.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can walk into a restaurant and order tea Earl Grey hot, and it manifests.
But you didn't manifest it out of nothing, though. Right? maybe that's what they do in the kitchen.
But you know, that's exactly my point, though. You know, I think about something like a cup of tea. I mean, it's insignificant, but you're absolutely right. How amazing in the scientific world can you step up to a replicator and literally speak a cup of tea into existence? I mean, Zachary, you're talking about, you know, it almost seems like the power of God. I mean, you know, let there be light, and there was. Let there be tea, and there is. But that cup of tea in the grand scheme of things is very insignificant in comparison to that same person having the power to destroy a starship and end 1,018 lives.
I'm glad we're talking about this. In fact, maybe we could make it our final topic before we lead into our final thoughts. But, you know, what distinguishes Star Trek from other kinds of science fiction and other kinds of fantasy? I'm thinking of things like the King Arthur tales with Merlin. Like, Merlin is a magician. He can manifest things at a command as well, right? It's all magic. It's mysticism. It's not science fiction. It's not technology, right? Star Trek takes this technological approach to such things. From our point of view, as the great science fiction classic author Arthur C. Clarke would have said, you know, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? So he would have said, replicators, it sure looks like magic if you don't understand how it works, right? It's like Merlin saying, you know, I want a cup of tea, and a cup of tea appears. But when Captain Picard does it, he's doing it with the computer's help. And I think it's interesting that speech acts, you can kind of take it in two different ways. You can kind of take it in this metaphysical, mystical kind of way, as if it were Merlin in the King Arthur tales manifesting stuff into existence out of nothing. But in Star Trek, it's always technological, right? You don't just blow up the Enterprise on a command. You use the computer's help.
Right.
The computer is a piece of technology. There's a mechanism that happens, right? You know, you say start the timer, and the timer starts, and then, you know, the antimatter containment gives out, and however that works, and then, you know, matter and antimatter collide, and then the ship explodes. There's a causal mechanistic chain of events that explains that. It's not mystical in any way. Does the science fiction component of Star Trek, the technological component of it, does that undermine the significance or the reality or the plausibility of speech acts in any way? Does it kind of explain them away? Like, if you have, you know, the Merlin / mystical approach to speech acts, you know, that seems really magical and interesting and metaphysical to me. When I give a technological version of that, like Captain Picard ordering a cup of Earl Grey, that's not deep and metaphysical or mystical to me. So if you take that contrast between those two different approaches to storytelling and how they read things that look, from our point of view, both of them can look like magic because we don't know how it works. But take other kinds of speech acts that we talked about, things like naming, things like weddings, things like taking an oath, things like, you know, christening a ship, whatever it is, right? These more significant ones, things like casting a vote, these really politically significant types of speech acts. Does the difference between those two different kinds of storytelling shed any light at all on how we should interpret speech acts here in the real world?
I really don't think so. And to differentiate, yeah, I mean, you can differentiate between Star Trek and perhaps some other forms of fantasy or science fiction. But on the same hand, the writers of Star Trek often inserted their own brand of fantasy in there. I'm thinking of, for instance, the Enterprise computer literally giving birth to a new entity. We had our ways of inserting a certain level of fantasy in there. And is
that's all Brandon Braga's weird stuff.
Indeed. Indeed. But, you know, here's the thing. We talk about, you know, the technological aspect, but I think the thing that is so compelling to those of us who are really Star Trek fans is that these technological advances are just that. They're advances. They are more advanced. I mean, you said it. We can't walk up to a replicator and say tea Earl Grey hot and end up with a cup of Earl Grey. All we're going to end up is the same molecules that were floating around before. No cup, no tea, no nothing. So there is a certain level of fantasy. But here's the thing. What we call science fiction today, tomorrow is going to be science fact. And it really boils down to this. Star Trek is, in and of itself, to some degree, its own speech act, Zachary, because, you know, you think about Captain Kirk when he first flipped open that communicator, you know, 30 years later, guess what? We have flip phones, and Captain Picard gives an order on a pad. And 20 years later, we have tablets, we have iPads. So I think in and of itself, Star Trek, it really becomes this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, its own speech act, if you will.
That's a really interesting way to put it. In fact, you used a phrase that Star Trek can be its own speech act. And I think I'm going to put this in the category of my final thoughts on the topic before we lead into the closing. If you think about the meaning of Star Trek in society, right? Star Trek has, in a lot of ways, changed the world. It's changed the world technologically. It had a role to play in changing the world socially and progressively, right? And this is all well-known stuff, and this shouldn't surprise anyone, right? But if you think of you know, on the one hand, Star Trek can be just a bunch of fanciful science fiction stories, right? On the other hand, if you imbue Star Trek with meaning, that Star Trek has a purpose and it has a social agenda, it has a message to say about the kind of world, the way the world should be, the kind of world and universe we want to see, you know, brought into fruition in some way, then, you know, Gene Roddenberry creating Star Trek is a kind of speech act.
Yeah.
All of Star Trek is a kind of political speech act, that in telling these stories, we are literally changing the shape and the tone and the structure of society as we know it, hopefully for the better. And so for my final thoughts, I just think that it's possible to think of all of Star Trek as a kind of speech act, that it has the power to change the world. And it has done that, and hopefully it will continue to do that for a long time to come.
I agree completely. And in terms of my own final thoughts, you know, I think about the fact that we have successfully transported a molecule from one place to another. Oh, don't get me wrong. We are light years away from being able to transport a human being through a transporter. But Zachary, just think about this. We have taken something that in 1967 was science fiction, and we've accomplished it on a small scale. We've taken the first bold step into fulfilling that vision. So absolutely, Star Trek becomes its own self-fulfilling prophecy, its own speech act, if you will. And it's social, it's political, it's technological. But I think what makes Star Trek the powerful speech act that it is the passion. You know, I think about the episode, The Storyteller from Deep Space Nine. In that particular episode, this village was protected because of a storyteller. And we find out in that episode, Zachary, that not just anybody can be the storyteller. O'Brien was terrible as a storyteller. He was a terrible storyteller because he lacked conviction. He didn't have the eloquence. He didn't have the passion to get out there and tell an effective story and hold off the Dalrock. We know that it took a certain level of conviction, passion. It took a certain eloquence. And so what we have in the Star Trek universe and what we have as Star Trek fans, we have this pattern. Why is it that Star Trek has endured for 50 years? It's because of speech acts, Zachary. When they canceled the series, the original series, it was speech acts that kept it on another season, and it was speech acts that brought it back. And here we are 50 years later, and we've had, you know, 5 live action series, we've had an animated series, we've had movies, we've got another movie coming, we've got a new TV show on the horizon, 2017, all because of the great stories, the eloquence of the stories, the passion of the people who make it, and the passion of the people who consume it. So at the end of the day, yeah, speech acts inside of Star Trek tell us a lot about the nature of speech acts. But at the end of the day, Star Trek is its own speech act. That's my final thoughts.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's hard for me because philosophically, I keep wanting to ask that really skeptical question. You know, yes, Star Trek has changed the world and hopefully will continue to do that. But what kind of change is that? Did it really change the world in some sort of deep metaphysical sense, or is this merely some sort of social construction? And I don't have a good answer to that, but I think it's very easy to get kind of swept away on this emotional roller coaster of Star Trek leading us into the future. And that's true in so many ways, right? You know, the existence of Star Trek has brought about events and concepts and ideas and interactions in the world that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So in that sense, yes, obviously it's changing the world. But is that some sort of deep metaphysical change in the kind of sense of like a person becoming president, or a ship being named the Enterprise, or two people taking a vow and now becoming married? Is it that kind of structural change in reality? It's in some sort of deep, meaningful sense, or is it some sort of human constructed social construct? And I don't have an answer to that, but it's important, I think, to keep the philosophical skepticism about this idea of speech acts in play, because it's not obvious at all that merely saying something changes reality in any obvious way. I think that's still not an obvious idea.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, I think you have a little bit of both, Zachary. Honestly, I social construction, convention, yes, absolutely. Are you changing, you know, the metaphysics in any way, shape, or form? Well, let's revisit this topic again when we have gone beyond that molecule and we have transported a man. Then you and I can have that metaphysical conversation.
You're saying we can have this discussion again after we've gone beyond?
Beyond.
Sounds good. Sign me up.
Sign me up. Well, listen, it's been fun talking about speech acts and performative speech in Star Trek, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
50 years, there's been something to carry it this far. In that vein of, hey, it's our generation or our era's mythic heroes that we can look up to. Do we dare put that in something that's lasted as long as, you know, literary-wise, Shakespeare and some of the other myths of the ancients that have found a purpose and a use that still speak to people?
The orb.
Well, the wonderful thing about Z'all is she just has it in spades. You know, I mean, she's been mistreated her entire life by her parents and yet has turned out to be this beautiful, amazing person. Part of that's probably Kira taking care of her for so long now.
Yeah.
Women at Warp.
Admiral Alan Alda came to visit Captain Coretta Scott King. Meanwhile, morale officer Beyonce is trying to deal with her new Weasley sweater. And
they're all partying at the First Contact party.
Melodic Treks.
This score is one of my favorites for Star Trek The Next Generation and is similar in many ways to a film score that I love. The episode is Data Lore, and the film score that I will compare this to is Alien by Jerry Goldsmith.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. Everyone, that helps us so much. It makes it much, much easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no worries. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And, of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website. You can grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the incredible perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
And if you leave us a voicemail, we might just play it right here on the podcast. Also, check us out on Twitter. Our handle is @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM. And find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave us a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. And as always, if you do so, please reach out to us either on the Babel Conference, on Twitter, or at any of our personal contacts. Let us know so we can look that up and share it right here on the podcast. So, Zachary, when you're not waiting with great anticipation for that bottle of Chateau Picard to hit the Enterprise B, where can our listeners find you around Trek FM and on the interwebs?
Well, on Facebook, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, and you can always find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you are not officiating at Starfleet weddings, where can people find you on the internet and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my handle is @CMichael1701. You can also find me on Instagram, CMichael1701. Zachary, we'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm. Executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Will Wynn, our content manager. And Richard Marquez, our production manager. We'd also like to give a shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. And Zachary, our newest associate producer, Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can connect with her. Her Twitter handle is @ChocoWeeble. That's @CHOCCOWEEBLE. Zachary and I would like to thank both of you for your support of Trek FM and of MetaTreks. We're glad to have you as part of the team. Well, thanks everyone for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before. That would be a good Riker bumper sticker.
Button your fly?
Yes. He's coming out of some new ensign just transferred to the Enterprise, and he comes strolling out of her quarters.
Well,
and
well, when he does the Riker maneuver, you know, you'd want to make double sure. I can picture Deanna like nudging him, like Will, zip it.
Yeah, the Picard maneuver is just pulling down the tunic. The Riker maneuver is pulling down the tunic and then zipping up the pants.
Poor Will Riker, he always gets a bad rap.